It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and it's December the 13th, 1976, Dialogue Conspiracy number 247. I wanted to suggest a list of reading books for listeners to give as Christmas presents. I made out a list of about 50 or 60 of the best books, current books, exposés on various conspiracies and assassinations that are out right now that are on the market that you won't be able to buy later. But there's so much news coming out with regard to the arsenal in Los Angeles and counterintelligence that I decided to do that this week. And then maybe next week it won't be too late to give you a list of books. I also want to talk about the committee in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to put that off except for a few words. You probably read this week that the Congress, they're being asked for $6.5 million to investigate the John Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination, and there's no mention of the Robert Kennedy assassination at this time. As you know, the people that listen regularly, the Select Committee on Assassinations in Washington, D.C. is something that I'm very suspicious of, and I'm taking a hands-off policy on it at the present time. I got a letter from Richard Sprague, the chief counsel and director for the Select Committee, and he wrote to me, "Dear Ms. Brussel, thank you for your letter expressing interest in the events surrounding the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King." He said, "We will be calling upon the assistance of numerous individuals and government officials. To this end, I greatly appreciate your interest. Your letter has been forwarded to our research department, which is responsible for conducting a thorough and comprehensive analysis of all documents and correspondence." So we'll see what his research department does with some of the information I sent to them. But I'm very skeptical of it. I'm skeptical because Mr. Sprague was selected to head this committee by an agent of the CIA, George O'Toole, who had been the CIA for many years, and he was the man who handpicked Mr. Sprague in Philadelphia. And also Richard Sprague, who's heading the new investigation, worked with Arlene Specter, the DA in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, for many, many years, and he claims that while working under him, and he admits that he worked with Arlene Specter, that he never once discussed the Kennedy assassination. Well, Arlene Specter was an attorney, a CIA attorney, on the Warren Commission. Every attorney there was from the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was the one that concocted the notorious Bullet 399 that was supposed to have gone through John Kennedy's back and arms and leg and fell out whole, a pristine bullet that was found on a stretcher, and it also went through John Connolly, went through John Kennedy's back and chest, and then went through John Connolly's back and chest and his arm and came out the wrist, and part of it is still lodged in his leg, and John Connolly had multiple surgery. This bullet, 399, this miracle bullet, was the concoction of Arlene Specter. Another very good researcher, Hal Weisberg, believes that there's a definite conflict of interest in having Richard Sprague as the chief counsel in this matter, because one of the first witnesses to be called would be Arlene Specter, and it's hardly likely that a man who's been working with a CIA partner for these many years and admits that he worked with Arlene Specter, and it's very unlikely that he's going to call Specter as a witness. The committee now is spending part of their $6 million down in Mexico at hotels and interviews trying to find a dry 13-year lead that was false in the beginning about Lee Harvey Oswald's contacts in Mexico City. And they can use that budget up for a little while following all the false leads. And all they would have to do would be to call in Arlene Specter. Another person they might call in and save some money is James Earl Ray. The newspaper says today that the Supreme Court turned down James Earl Ray's plea for a new trial. Of course, the San Francisco Examiner says the assassin Ray loses Supreme Court plea, And yet there is no evidence, ballistic or otherwise, that James Earl Ray was the assassin of Reverend Martin Luther King. But each generation gets this lie perpetuated. They don't say the alleged assassin. James Earl Ray claimed in his appeal that both the FBI and the local police department deprived him of his rights, that he was framed, and that he was told to plead guilty. They said that he'd get the death penalty if he didn't. And two lawyers, Arthur Haynes, he said, made a deal, and Percy Foreman made a deal. And they worked with a writer, and Mr. Huey, William Bradford Huey. And Huey had told him, I'll use the book money to pay your lawyer's fees. And he claims that Huey was planning the case through contact agreement to pay the lawyers, but that they were just locking James Earl Ray up without a trial. In seeking the Supreme Court review, it was Ray's attorney who said that this case raises major constitutional issues with respect to voluntariness of the plea. There was a waiver of conflict of interest on the part of the criminal defense attorneys, both attorneys that represented James Earl Ray. And there's professional and ethical competence that is questionable at this time. James Earl Ray never had a trial that met a full jury, and he was forced to plead guilty, and he claims that there's a lot behind the scenes. His attorney said the charge is that those who did kill Martin Luther King are still at large, and they are protected in part by the unwillingness of the courts to face these unpleasant facts. Now, if the congressional committees would give James Earl Ray $1 million out of their $6 million and give Sirhan Sirhan $1 million and a good psychiatrist at Sirhan Trust so that he could be deprogrammed, and they worked on a budget of $4 million, they could just follow those leads right there. And I think that that would be a good way to begin the investigation. Here you have Arthur Brammer, James Earl Ray, and Sirhan Sirhan, who claim that they know something about these cases. They could provide information. And Congress and the Supreme Court ignored them totally. There's no mention about calling them as witnesses or giving them the right to say, you know, what happened. In the meanwhile, these congressional investigators and secretaries and staff of 70 are going to draw in a budget of $6 million or more following dry leads, and I think it's really pathetic. I don't have much confidence in this whole setup, and every day as I see it going on, I have less. That I do want to talk at length also about the Howard Hughes story, and I'm not going to do that today, but I suggest that you buy Time magazine if you haven't already and put it away. There's an account in there by James Phelan, who wrote a book on Howard Hughes, and he describes Hughes' death, how he was like a victim of Buchenwald or Dachau, and he describes the Mormon mafia around him, one psychologist and four chauffeurs. They were not legal secretaries. He describes leaving Las Vegas, if that was Hughes or if it was a double, whoever, where they kept bottles of urine for no medical purposes for as long as 3 years. And he talks about the filth and the stench. Absolutely no reason to keep old urine 3 years old in bottles and filth. And he describes what's the literal torture of a person. And then to contradict that, we hear that Howard Hughes was flying an airplane in London in 1972. And J.J. Arms, the investigator, wrote a book, and he gave interviews just recently, that Howard Hughes was in El Paso visiting him as a very reputable citizen who wanted some jobs done. And you have these contradictions, and everybody is getting a book published on the subject. You can either say he was a very refined type of English, a man with a Van Dyke beard and a crisp little smile and hearty handshake, or you can say he was a bubbling idiot who didn't know what was going on, and he was fed chocolate bars and kept suppressed. But I think the important thing to do is to read Time magazine and see the background of these aides, the little bit of glimpse they give, and see the physical condition of this human being. Because what we're seeing is the far right wing, who've been behind many of these conspiracies, doing things to their own, such as injecting Martha Mitchell with what I believe was that dangerous and lethal cancer that she died within 3 years, or Dorothy Hunt's plane crash going down, and Howard Hughes being kept a prisoner. And one of the fantasies of this story was that Hughes only touched things with Kleenex on his fingers. He wouldn't touch any paper. But that could be reversed to say that they didn't want any fingerprints because the man that they kept there as the body while all of this control system went on with satellites and communications and weapon systems and using him as a front for the CIA, the double couldn't be recognized either. There's no proof that Howard Hughes wouldn't have touched something. There's every reason to believe that the double couldn't touch it and that some fingerprint would touch something that would tell us it wasn't Howard Hughes. Incidentally, in the news today, Monday the 13th, a gentleman passed away in Ibiza, Spain. He was the one that was known as the hoaxer, the painter, Emil Dahori. He was 65 years old, and he, according to the news account, died of an apparent overdose. It was a suicide, and there was no note. And it was this gentleman that worked with Clifford Irving on Ibiza, and they did this story on the duplicating of paintings and the hoax. The story in Paris was that he committed suicide because he was going to trial for his various hoaxes and art forgeries. They involved a man in Texas. And according to the information I had on the burial of Howard Hughes in 1971 in Greece, the story that I was given was that Clifford Irving, writing the book at this time, was in some way linked to the Aristotle Onassis Howard Hughes scheme of thing. It was this producing of the book by Clifford Irving, this on Howard Hughes, that caused a gentleman in the Bahamas to have a radio telephone conversation with six persons from the news media that he selected to verify that Hughes, in fact, was alive, because there were people that said he wasn't alive or wasn't in Las Vegas, Nevada at all. So in order to put all those rumors to rest, a man was created who got on the telephone, and I have a book at home with the conversation. It's typed up of that 1972 conference, and this man wasn't answering any of the personal questions, and he went off on a long diatribe on how airplanes were built. So now I'm wondering, it's just an if, and I'm asking you the question, and it's worth throwing around in our minds. There's the big court decision coming up this next month on the Howard Hughes wills. There's about 20 or 30 of them, and then there's that famous Mormon will that they have to decide if it's authentic or not. And knowing how these people are pushing that will, particularly Noah Diedrich, who is made the executor. I just read last week the court record, a resume of the court record in Los Angeles, and Noah Diedrich wanted to pursue the fact that this was an authentic will. And he said to the judge that he would get the assistance of former chief of police, one of the chief executives of the Los Angeles Police Department, and also a commander in the National Guard, and that those people would help him find a will of Howard Hughes. Well, it was right after that that the Mormon will showed up. And knowing the links of the CIA to the Howard Hughes empire, and also the link of Clifford Irving to the whole Howard Hughes saga, I wonder if by any chance they were trying to find a master forger who could produce that will that was written allegedly in 1968. And I wonder, I'm just asking this, if Emil Dahori didn't die and it wasn't a suicide, if he died now because of the remote possibility, working with people in Texas, that's where he ripped them off on the art duplication, working with Clifford Irving, and knowing the CIA counterintelligence that was involved in the whole Hughes organization, I wonder if this untimely note without suicide without a note has anything to do at all with the experts are being brought in now to identify the will, because he made some comment before he died about signing signatures, and Dahori had made the remark about, I never signed people's signatures, and denial, of course, is part of an intelligence cover-up, and it's interesting that he dies now just at a time where they are going to rule out whether or not it is a forgery, and because of his links to Clifford Irving and Irving's links to the whole Hughes story. His death was important, and it just didn't get too much notice. That's why I thought I'd talk about it, because you might not have even picked it up in the newspaper or linked it to the Hughes will, which I'm beginning to wonder about. Well, the last few days, we've had newspaper articles on the arsenals in California. They've unearthed what is supposed to be the largest private arsenal in the state. It is the largest so far. But I might say that one reason I got interested in the Kennedy assassination was because I had heard in 1960 and 61 that the paramilitary Minutemen were very busy at that time, just prior to the Kennedy assassination. had plans to make these military arsenals every 20 miles with the help of the United States government and the Nazi Party to have them spaced at the equivalent of every 20 miles across the United States. And I also was aware of the Barker Ranch, which I have said all along was a safe house for the Manson family. Remember, they were hastening this anti-black race war. They left credit cards in the black part of town, and they're violently anti-Semitic, anti-black. As I say, I've heard of these caches, so it didn't surprise me when a Donald Wiggins was named and fingered, and he took various people to where they had buried these caches, and they range in this particular area from Lancaster to Ontario and San Bernardino. Now, there's enough military equipment in this one find for a 200-man army. U.S. military helicopters are using infrared cameras to see if they can pick up more caches. They're looking for bunkers where weapons might be hidden. There's rifles, pistols, hand grenades, mortars. It's French, Japanese, German, Russian, U.S. machine guns, and 50 caliber anti-aircraft weapons is some of that arsenal. Save articles on this because you'll find that there are more arsenals around the country, and hopefully maybe somebody will speak up and unearth them. Now, along with the anti-black, anti-Jewish, anti-communist domestic arsenals of that type is a big story which took place in San Francisco December the 1st. That was just 13 days ago. It was in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I've waited 13 days, and I haven't found any coverage of this particular story that I'm going to share with you on the air in any newspaper that I take, and I take 10 a day. And the name, the lead article, is The Possible Break in San Francisco Sniping Case. And this has to do with a David Shore who was arrested and held by the police since November the 30th, or a few days before that, and the story broke on December the 1st. And as I say, there's not a word in any of the national newspapers or the Los Angeles Times. Now, one of the biggest stories in New York City and San Francisco, Los Angeles, is crime in the streets. We're hearing so much about street crime. And the biggest centers of domestic counterintelligence of the Nazi paramilitary far-right wing are Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Chicago. The Red Squads doing the bombings have definitely been linked to the White House, the CIA, and the FBI at centers of counterintelligence. As a matter of fact, J. Walter Thompson, the advertising agency that gave us Richard Nixon and the White House staff, represents, or did represent until just recently, unless they've stopped, the San Francisco Police Department. Now, Charles Gain, the chief of police of San Francisco, was in active in counterintelligence in the Oakland area. And he was kicked out of there because they had so much violence, so many killing and chasing of Black Panthers and Black people, and then he left for several mysterious years, I believe one in Canada and one in the South, and returned to the San Francisco area. And so that's the clue, because of Charles Gain's background, that San Francisco was ready for counterintelligence. And I've mentioned that before on Dialogue Conspiracy. Well, who is this David Shore who was arrested by police just at a time when sniping was taking place in Los Angeles, in San Francisco? He's described, these are quotations from the San Francisco Chronicle, December 1st and 2nd. He's described as a brilliant young University of California student. He graduated from the School of Criminology. His parents are Irving and Marville Shore. They're both federal administrative law judges and lawyers. He's now attending law school, his first year in law school. He's an honor student, outstanding grades while he attended criminology in law school. And his parents live atop Nob Hill in San Francisco. His father was one-time attorney for the State Division of Law Enforcement. His father also ran unsuccessfully three times as a Republican candidate for state assembly. Young Shore was being held for the sniper shooting in San Francisco. New York cab driver, if you remember, on the front page of the Chronicle, Bernard Ostrager, 55, was shot for no apparent reason November 23rd at the corner of Powell Street and O'Farrell, downtown San Francisco. Sharon Harrett, 33, was hit by sniper's bullet the next morning, November 24th, 1976, two blocks from where Ostrager was shot. As soon as Sharon Harrett was shot on November 24th, the mayor, George Moscone, in San Francisco immediately ordered 200 more policemen, San Francisco needs police on the street to work overtime because, in quotes, we have to stop the random snipings and the street crimes of San Francisco. Well, it just so happened that November 30th, it was a few days after these random shootings, just about 6 days later, David Shore was across the bay over at UC campus at the Law Library at the School of Law in Bold Hall when a burglar alarm tripped off. Evidently, he wasn't supposed to be there. He was up to some kind of mischief. And a burglar alarm tripped off at the library, and the police from Oakland came over. Not San Francisco police, but the Oakland police. And they ran after this particular David Shore, and they began a chase. He ran out of the library, got into his car. He was driving 90 miles an hour through Berkeley. He smashed one of the police cars, and he was taken into custody in Oakland. And at that time, he was charged with two first-degree armed robbery, two counts possession of stolen property, possession of burglary tools, and it gets even better, his links to the police department. He had possession of unauthorized keys to many of the state facilities. He had got keys into buildings that belonged to the state. He was charged with one count of assault with a deadly weapon, being his car, two vehicle code violations, and at the time of his arrest, he had a loaded pistol with him. But that wasn't all. He also had newspaper clippings about the two O'Farrell Street shootings of Sharon Harrod and Bernard Ostrager, and he also had in his car an advertisement for a silencer, a .22 caliber pistol. So they went to his apartment for a search warrant. He had a separate apartment just a few blocks from where the shootings were taking place, apart from the Nob Hill apartment of his mother and father, lawyers, active Republicans, state Republicans, and active with the Criminal Department of California. The father had a position before. They took a search warrant to the apartment and found a .22 automatic silencer with 10-shot automatic pistol. They found a large quantity of ammunition. They found parts of locks and hundreds of key blanks, and they found a key-making machine in his apartment so that he could duplicate keys, and he had the machine right there. He had a AR-7 .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle in a paper bag. He owned handcuffs, and then he had a Polaroid camera from the police department, San Francisco State University, that belonged to them. He had stacks of admission records from the U.S. Law School. And this is very important in counterintelligence, and I'm very suspicious of it, because when school started this September, I had an article of a black girl at Hunter Point who got a scholarship that was supposed to start school the next week, and she was murdered. I watched in the Washington Post, there was a young black student who had a scholarship and was leaving Monday for school, and he was shot in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. And I noticed that there possibly be a pattern of black young people not waiting till their leaders, racist, anti-black people, murdering these black people. Maybe the next in line would be a white student to replace them. And these scholarship students, I noticed, too, within 1 week, and I don't take papers from across the country, but I wondered what is going on here, and there may be many more. This particular student with his ammunition weapon had admission records from the law school. As I say, the Polaroid camera from the police department at San Francisco State and parts of semi-automatic rifles. He not only had the camera from the San Francisco Police Department at San Francisco State University, but he worked with the San Francisco Police Department. He now works as a full-time civilian radio dispatcher at the San Francisco State University while attending law school. Now, some of you don't recall, or maybe you don't know, that James Earl Ray, the alleged assassin of Reverend Martin Luther King, was able to leave the location behind the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, the day that Martin Luther King was killed, and the radio dispatchers gave wrong information about a getaway car so that the police all went in one direction, and James Earl Ray was able to leave Tennessee and then get up to Canada and then get to London and Portugal and back to London, and he was on his way to Rhodesia thanks to the radio dispatchers. The day that Lee Harvey Oswald was apprehended, John Kennedy was killed, the radio dispatchers gave a description of Lee Harvey Oswald. To this day, the members of the Warren Commission staff, and I've seen their correspondence, can't explain the absolute description of somebody that they said they believed killed John Kennedy, because Oswald was on the sixth floor of a building, kneeling at the time. If he was on the sixth floor, I don't believe he was, but the only witness across the street who said he saw the rifle sticking out couldn't see him standing up in that position. So the radio dispatcher is very important giving misinformation, or this young student could give misinformation and say, I saw a black man flee, like the zebra killings or whatever. This short boy worked as a radio dispatcher at San Francisco Civilian Police, San Francisco State University, and he also had applied and was ready to start a job December the 8th. He was arrested at Bolt Hall in Oak over at Berkeley, the university, 30th of November, but he was to begin work as a dispatcher for the San Francisco Police Department on December the 8th. And you can see why, with this background, the news has been a total blackout since December the 2nd. If there's been anything in the papers, send it to me. I haven't seen it at all. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle on December the 2nd said, we cannot rule out the gun in, we can't rule it in or out, the gun that he had that did this other multiple shooting. There are enough matching characteristics with bullets removed from the victims to warrant a further test case. Mr. Shore is on, I think there's bail now. He's on the outside. He hasn't been charged with anything. They haven't denied that his gun matched the bullets of these victims in San Francisco. They said he will be charged with having a silencer with it, which is a felony. And he was arrested. There's been no information on this case at all. In the meanwhile, the San Francisco Chronicle, December the 12th, this last week, had an article on violence in San Francisco and snipers and how we should get more police and crime in San Francisco and how everyone's afraid. And yet, when they have one person like that that is picked up on a fluke, there's a total blackout, just like there's a blackout on the Chowchilla case, when the suggestion that it linked, again, to the paramilitary right-wing Zodiac killer operation, the minute that came out, the very first day when Stan Borman mentioned it on the 5 o'clock news, of the similarity of the Zodiac messages, and I have reason to believe that's the International White Guard, a paramilitary right-wing, anti-black, anti-Semitic fascist organization. The very afternoon, and it can be documented that that came on the news at 5 o'clock, then all information about the Chowchilla case went off the news totally across the country, and we don't hear a word about these people that were supposed to have done the kidnapping of the 26 children. Now, one of the things that is important for the holidays, in addition to getting new books, is to browse through old bookstores and used bookstores. And there's some excellent old books, and I have friends that collect old books that are historically valuable. And for the remaining of the show, I want to run down quickly a book that a friend shared with me this week. It's called Army of Spies, and it has to do with hooded men, the same kind of people that I believe are behind the Manson case, the arsenals in Los Angeles, the San Francisco violence. And this kind of operation didn't begin yesterday. The Armies of Spies was written by Joseph Gallome, published by Macmillan in 1939. And this is the introduction of this book. It says, this startling book deals with espionage as it is today since 1933. He's describing 6 years of espionage. He said, spies used to work in small groups, and now they work in armies. It is their business to invade by thousands any country known as a fever spot. They spread disinformation and propaganda. They tamper with machinery and key industries. They introduce livestock epidemics. They make a special study of water supply, communications, transport systems. And when the time is right, they promote assassinations and incidences of violence. They are international wreckers on a vast and highly organized scale. And they are referred to in this book as the Hooded Ones. You remember the Zodiac wore a hood, the men wore a hood over their face at the time of the Chowchilla kidnapping, the Ku Klux Klan that we're hearing about at the Marine bases, who also exist all over the country as a network, are the Hooded Ones. As you recall, last week and for many, many weeks on Dialogue Conspiracy, I've referred to the turning point of espionage seems to be when the Tsar was removed from power in Russia after World War I in 1918, and that time period. And from that time, it seemed that there were a group of people that vowed to get communism out of Russia. And would do it by terror or any means possible, assassinations or terrors. Now, the Hooded, as I say, are in the newspaper down at Camp Pendleton in San Diego. And this book, it's called The Armies of Spies. I'm trying to locate it through some used old bookstores. It was just on loan. It goes into the operation that Adolf Hitler had in France in 1934, which I think is comparable to the operation which is taking place in the United States, getting it ready to prepare for a fall and a coup in case we go too far to what these people declare is the left. France fell within 24 hours, became a fascist state, but the groundwork was set in 1934. And the Nazis were illegal in France in 1934, and they set up secret cells, and they had regular meetings, and they were active in Spain in the revolution from 1936 on, and they planned violence against individuals. They planned explosions. And at first, France didn't believe that the violence was coming from Germany, or didn't dream it was coming from Nazi Germany. And this book describes a matter called the Rosselli Affair, which is interesting because there's a Mr. Bouvier in France, which was Jacqueline Kennedy's maiden name, her father's name. And a Mr. Bouvier, it turns out, was behind these operations. And I have to do more research now into Jacqueline Bouvier because of her links, see if she's related, because of her links to Aristotle Onassis and the Greek Nazis that were in power while she was presiding with Onassis over in Greece. A Mr. Bouvier turned out, his son turned out to be one of the killers involved in the Rosselli Affair, and a John Rosselli, and then appears again at the White House at the time of John Kennedy's assassination. And the names are in this early book in 1934, maybe coincidental and maybe not. But at the time, the Rosselli Affair, this Carlo Rosselli was from a wealthy family. He was a professor in Genoa, and he was giving Mussolini a lot of trouble. He went to Spain at the time of the revolution started, then went back to France, where he and his brother were brutally murdered. And the Hooded Ones were a group, a secret organization that was formed after Leon Blum came to power in France. And the equivalent of Blum is like Jimmy Carter in power now. Blum represented the left, more of the left than the right wing. And there were 200 families of the industrialists that wanted to do something about it. 200 families owned the bulk of French wealth, just like 200 families owned the bulk of American wealth. And offices were set up, and they used bombs. The Hooded Ones used bombs, and they bombed buildings and left books around, making it look like the left was there. They had a handbook that had a name. It was called Special Instructions Communist Party. And in case anyone was caught, their instructions fell to the wrong hands, it would look like the communists were doing this kind of violence. And they taught techniques in street fighting and special forces and combat, use of automatic revolvers and hand grenades and submachine guns, the same kind of weapons that were found in California this week and are hidden all over the country, provided by the military, were used. But the handbook, in case they were caught, was called The Secret Instructions to the Communist Party. At the time that I wrote the SLA as the CIA, I noted in this particular article on page 10 that the right-wing CIA was using a book by Carlos Marighella called The Mini Manual for Urban Guerrilla Warfare, and that Lee Harvey Oswald kept on the coffee table in Texas, Das Kapital, while he'd meet with 20 to 30 Nazi or right-wing military security people linked to the oil exploration and engineers. While Oswald was doing that, he always kept Das Kapital on the coffee table, and every witness just about saw it, even though it's really not available to examine now. Also, this elaborate spy system in France, before Hitler was able to take over, was fronted by a man called the Engineer. And Lee Harvey Oswald, when he arrived from the Soviet Union to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, met with engineers, George Bowie, Max Clark, George de Morenschel, Paul Rygotorovsky, all high up links to the Solidaris, the white Russian organization, and they were engineers, and that was the front in France, and it is the front here. They had an office where they kept their weapons, and it was called the Healing Office, and the man advertised it was a center for healing. And they suggested hypnotism and modern techniques of healing, and it actually was a place where machine guns were stored. And they used a boarding house where genteel little old ladies lived, and under there were caches of weapons. And in the foyer of this particular boarding house was the Hooded Ones, a statue of the Hooded Ones, and they began to investigate that these Hooded Ones were a formation of a secret army. And they went into this army, and the organization was called the Secret Comité Secret d'Action Revolutionnaire. The letters spell C-S-A-R, and that was the organization of the Hooded Ones. And in the cellars in France, getting ready for the overthrow, and it worked because within 24 hours, all of France belonged to Hitler. And they had done their groundwork since 1933-34, and they had spread bombings and terrorisms. And someone, a simple person like a Rosselli, the Rosselli brothers were murdered because they were critical of Mussolini in Italy. And it turned out that the German Nazis had killed the Rosellis in France, and nobody made the connection to the Nazis. And I hope in this country that we don't wait so long to make some of these connections. They had radio transmitters, they had radio short waves, they accumulated addresses, which reminds me of this boy in San Francisco, David Shore, with his names of admissions to schools. And in one cache, they had hand grenades, 400 hand grenades, explosives, 100 cartridges of calibers, revolvers, submachine guns. And they also had Italian and German weapons in France, just like the Minutemen have stored in California, the paramilitary Nazis, and the same kind of linkage, the same mentality, have Italian-German weapons in California stored along with Russian and American. They had the same thing in Europe. Now, there were bombs found that were identical to the ones that blew up the Rue de Presburg. They thought that Mr. Blum's party was blamed at the time. The leftists were blamed, and they found weapons and caches in the house, this boarding house for genteel ladies, where the weapons were kept. Remember, I mentioned also in Dialogue Conspiracy, this man who's done hits for the CIA who told me that the contracts go to a professor, a teacher at universities, Brigham Young in Salt Lake City, and then to what is supposed to be a house for women, a whorehouse or a women's house in Chicago, where the instructions and assignments are given so that these brave, courageous men hide behind the boarding house of a genteel lady or a whorehouse to signal off their killing programs. As they began to collect some of the arsenals in France and find out that Mr. Bouvier was behind this, then they began to link various violences and bombings with the extreme right wing and not the left. And we were made to believe, or they were made to believe, that the left was doing it all along. It was the office called the CSAR, which was synonymous with Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy. And another office that they hid behind was the Maritime and River Transport Mortgage Company. It was a front for a semi-military organization with a general staff and a medical corps. The Maritime River Transport Mortgage Company was able to have, they had blank papers where they manufactured passports. They planned for armed troops. They had detailed information of personnel and organizations of police departments of our principal cities, which, again, the Shoreburg boy was working with the police departments. They kept notepaper and other stationery, which was stolen from the military establishment. That's debatable whether it was stolen or given to them. They had lists of buildings with their exits and entrances, the sewers of Paris. Remember, or maybe you don't, the two men were arrested in Santa Barbara at the time that Squeaky Fromm was arrested in Sacramento for allegedly trying to kill Gerald Ford, and they were on $100,000 bail. We've never heard of that trial. That's been off the news. They each were held for $100,000, and they had the sewer plans of Sacramento, but they didn't get up there that day. They had plans for the interior newspaper offices. They kept facsimile of signatures so that they could forge for important ministers of the government, and lists of high functionaries and parliamentarians to be arrested at a given signal. At the time of Watergate, Robert Mardian from the Justice Department and G. Gordon Liddy were at the archives watching demonstrations of German Nazi movies. They're pro-Nazi, and Robert Mardian has lists for internal security of every person who would be arrested at a time of a given emergency and was giving to the Republicans. They also planned for the seizure of buses, which reminds me of Chowchilla. Maybe that was a test case. And they were into means of transportation. They were interested in transportation. Now, Mr. Bouvier, his name is Jean-Marie Bouvier, a Paris industrialist, turned out to be linked to this organization, the CASR, which spells Czar, to bombings at the Etoile. His son was involved in the murder of the Rosselli brothers. And another person, André Hugo, was mentioned as being involved in murdering the Rosselli brothers. Now, this is interesting that a young Bouvier did that, because I don't know the answers yet. I just got this information this week. But I'm going to ask some questions. I like to ask questions, because Jacqueline Bouvier was educated at the Sorbonne, and she married Senator John Kennedy when he was a senator. It's common knowledge that Joe Kennedy wanted his father, wanted John Kennedy to become president of the United States. There's a book out claiming that the oldest son was killed in an airplane crash purposely during World War II so that he couldn't become president. But everybody who knew Joe Kennedy knew that he wanted his son to become president. And Jacqueline Bouvier, educated in France at the Sorbonne, who may or may not be a relative of Jean-Marie Bouvier, the industrialist whose son was involved in counterintelligence, married Senator John Kennedy. And after he was killed, she went immediately or shortly thereafter to Aristotle Onassis, who helped put the first Nazis into power in Greece since World War I. She lived there during the whole part of the Nazi military junta in Greece. Jackie's stepfather, when her mother remarried again, was Mr. Hugh Auchincloss, who just died 2 weeks ago, and his obituary described him as in Navy intelligence during World War II, which was also the time of Project Paperclip when Nazis 652 were brought to the United States. And Mr. Auchincloss had a 46-acre estate at McLean, Virginia, also the headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency. He lived nearby. His first marriage was to Amaya de Chapropotsky, I can't pronounce it very well. It would be interesting to know whether he was linked to the Solidaris and the White Russians and the Nazis that were doing that violence in France. And then many of them moved to the United States. And the ones that I studied were in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. In fact, Janet U. Auchincloss, Jackie Bouvier Kennedy's mother and stepfather were friendly with George and Jean de Morenschild. That was Lee Harvey Oswald's babysitter. And the 26th Volume of the Warren Commission hearings have a letter that de Morenschild had written to them. He knew them and was a guest in their home. And he had represented his family, the Nobel oil fields in Russia, before the Tsar was kicked out. So you have links here to the Tsar and to Nazis. De Morenschild was followed from New York to Corpus Christi during World War II for allegedly being, they suspected him being a Nazi spy at the time. That was Oswald's friend. That was a friend of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy's parents. And it's quite a coincidence of history. There are coincidences here that have to be delved in further. As I say, the Bouvier family, wealthy background, French background, working with Nazis in helping France fall, working with white Russian agents titled the CSAR, the Tsar, and then you have Jacqueline Bouvier and marrying Senator John Kennedy, and then joining up in Greece where the Nazis were again in power, considering her reluctance to open any of this. I think the history of the Bouviers will demand more scrutiny at this time. And also, these two Rosselli brothers were killed in France by the son of the industrialist Bouvier, and a John Rosselli was brought to this country illegally from Italy, and he was always threatened to have his passport taken back or be deported. And he was instrumental in bringing that woman to the White House that John Kennedy used to sleep with, this Judith Exner. And I'm wondering if the Rosselli family had any role in this. You know that John Rosselli was murdered this last year, 1976, put in a drum and allegedly was supposed to be drowned, but the body surfaced. And you have a Rosselli that's tampering with John Kennedy, his sex life in the White House, providing his mistresses. And you have the Bouviers in France and in America. So, and you have these same common organizations, the CSAR and the Nazis, and the stockpiling of weapons and the similarities to the counterintelligence of the means that this boy had in San Francisco and the news blackout and the means of stockpiling in California. So I'll be doing a little homework on these matters in the weeks to come. And for gift giving for Christmas, if you're all out shopping, buy some good books the researchers have written. There's a great number of them, and they're all, many of them are good. We'll discuss them hopefully next week. And get used books if you can't afford. The new books are expensive, and there's some good paperbacks around. But give books of information and instead of all these other traps and appliances, and help spread information, because it is gratifying and it'll last forever. Then you can pass it on to your family and hold on to these books before they're out of print. Time is up on Dialogue Conspiracy. I'll see you next week. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. Thank you.